Welcome to the Ad Nauseam Podcast, where classical gourmands everywhere can finally get their fill. Join us for a delectable discussion of Greco-Roman civilization stretching from the Minoans and Mycenaeans through the Renaissance and right down to the present. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here are your hosts, Dr. David Noe and Dr. Jeff Winkle.
Welcome, listener, to episode 17 of the Ad Nauseam Podcast. My name is David Noe. I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Jeff Winkle. How are you, Jeff?
I'm feeling really good today.
All right. So we got a shout out today to a friend of mine, actually, a good friend of my daughter's, Ms. Lindy Shoemaker, who's from nearby Zeeland, Michigan. She's a fairly new listener. She's enjoying the classics, finds it fills her time between studies.
Fantastic. Thank you, Lindy.
Yeah. Thanks, Lindy. Keep listening. And what do we have today, Jeff, for the listener?
We're picking it up where we left off last week. We're talking about Euripides and Euripides' play, The Alcestis.
All right.
So we're going to drop in fairly soon in medias res, kind of picking up where we left off.
Oh, nice. Yes. Horatian tag there.
But if you're just jumping in as a new listener, we're going to fill in some of the background too.
Yeah, we'll give you a little bit of review so you won't be totally lost. Obviously, we'd like you to listen to the previous 16 episodes. But if you don't have time for that, it's okay. You can just feast on this one a little
bit. It's good.
Now, Jeff, you have an opening quote for us, don't you, as is our custom?
Yes, I do. And this comes from a work that I used when I taught this play one time in a Greek class. And I really came to like this edition. This is from Euripides Alcestis' Notes and Commentary by C.A. Lushing and H.M. Roisman of 2003, University of Oklahoma Press. And it's a nice Greek edition of the play itself, but lots of good discussion.
So what is it with, if I may interrupt just a second,
yeah,
scholars using only initials? I see here C.A.E. Lushing and H.M. Roisman.
I don't know. I guess it sounds more, is that more impressive?
I don't know. Your middle initial is T, isn't it?
It is.
So J.T. Winkle?
I don't go by J.T., though, okay. So maybe I should.
I think it would add a certain amount of credibility.
Though we don't want people confusing me with Justin Timberlake, which...
You know. It's likely. I've seen your dance moves.
Yes, unfortunately, that's true.
Yeah, on with the quote.
So this quote comes from, I think this is actually, it's Roisman talking back to Lushing. They go back and forth about their interpretations of the play. And so Roisman writes here, "My view is that Alcestis is more than a match for Admetus. Admetus causes tremendous suffering mainly for Alcestis, but also for himself because of who he is. An egotistical, self-absorbed, and obtuse man with a limited capacity for understanding anything but his own immediate wants. Thus, he blames Alcestis for betraying him by dying and accuses his father of causing Alcestis' death without realizing his own responsibility."
Oh, that's great. And in fact, I didn't realize it, but that is exactly my interpretation of the play.
I was just going to ask, does that ring true to you? Yeah.
Yes, and I don't know exactly why. It probably says a lot about me. I do not like the character of Admetus.
No, he's really unlikable. I mean, and more so than, you know, like Oedipus, and Oedipus the king is unlikable because he's flying off the handle.
Yeah, but I respect Oedipus.
Exactly.
I feel bad for him for what he's suffered.
Exactly, but Admetus brings all of this on himself.
And he's so disgusting.
Why does he disgust you?
Well, because I don't understand why Alcestis loves him so much.
Well, yeah, that's completely hidden from the audience.
I understand why Admetus loves her. Who wouldn't love a beautiful woman who's willing to die for you?
Indeed.
But the mystery is, why does she love him? He's a total loser.
Right. I mean, I've heard this argument that she agrees to die to get away from him. I buy that argument to some degree.
You buy it. Well, it's interesting, but it's really not supported by the text at all.
No.
So what we'd like to give our listeners today, really, as we go through the Alcestis, is not just a bird's eye, 30,000-foot view of the play, something that they no doubt could get in any kind of class. Maybe they've had a Greek tragedy class before. And we want to also give them something more than they could get from a quick Wikipedia peruse or something along those lines. We want to drill down into the interpretation of this play especially.
That's right. We're going to take a close look. We're going to go scene by scene.
Microscopic.
Microscopic. We're going to be reading some translation.
Painfully precise.
Oh, painfully. It's going to be so painful, right? No, it's going to be, yeah, it'll be precise, but a lot of fun along the way too.
All right.
Yeah. All right, Dave, recap a bit of what we talked about last week and get us to the part in the play we need to start from.
Sure. So last week, we quickly sketched out the history of tragedy, some of the reasons that people think, scholars think it arose in Athens. We talked about the biography of Euripides a little bit, where he came from, where he fit with respect to Aeschylus, his predecessor, and Sophocles, his other predecessor. And then we looked at the play itself, the first quarter of it. And we talked about the prologue. Apollo begins the prologue. He talks about the reasons for his visit to the house of Admetus. Jeff, if I'm remembering correctly, Apollo was upset because Zeus had killed his son Asclepius with a lightning bolt.
That's right. Okay. So, and Zeus killed him because he had brought Hippolytus back from the dead, which is a no-no. You can't
do
that kind of thing.
That.
And in retaliation, Apollo kills Zeus's Cyclopes.
That's right. So Zeus's grandson, Asclepius, is Zeus's grandson, as it turns out. But a lightning bolt will do, and down with Asclepius. Apollo, in anger, retribution, kills the Cyclopes. Why does Zeus care about them?
Well, they fashion his thunderbolts. So without his thunderbolts, Zeus has fewer things to throw around.
Okay, yeah. All right. And then, as punishment for Apollo, things just keep piling up, don't they?
Yeah.
He's sent off to the house of Admetus for a year.
Right. So where he is ostensibly going to be a god serving as like a mortal servant to this man.
So this is humiliating.
Very humiliating.
Apollo has to sit at table with the other servants. He's got to bring food and drink to Admetus. And this is very demeaning, degrading to Apollo, who's a pretty powerful Olympian.
Right. Now, having said that, I mean, my sense from, I mean, we don't get that in real time. We don't get scenes of Apollo serving,
it's
right?
It's backstory.
But my sense is that, and disagree if you think this is off.
Oh, I will.
Oh, yeah. But Admetus, I get the sense that Admetus didn't really treat Apollo like a servant. My sense is that Apollo had it pretty good for this year.
Well, that would be difficult to do, wouldn't it? If you knew the true identity of your guest, it's hard to treat them like a normal person.
Right.
If you've ever been in the presence of celebrity, yeah, treat me just like anyone else, they say. Well, mm-hmm. Now you've ruined it. There's no possibility of that.
I like that analogy. Yeah. I mean, this gets into a little bit where I might feel a little bit of sympathy for Admetus. In some ways, he's trapped by this relationship. And so it reminds me of, you know, the famous story of Cassandra promising to bear Apollo's child and then breaking that promise and the dangers of saying no to a god. Right. And so in some ways, you know, we were just talking about how we didn't like Admetus and we found him disgusting. There's a lot about his personality that is awful. But is he in some ways, you know, trapped? Is he doomed simply by having Apollo in his house?
Well, his potential character flaw is what? Hyperphilosinia?
Yeah.
Is that how it goes?
He's a people pleaser.
That's a jaw-breaking term, and I don't mean people pleaser, but hyperphilosinia.
Yes.
Which is an excessive or overwrought sense of hospitality.
Right, which both Lushing and Roisman suggest that for an ancient audience, they might have seen that as the central element in the play.
Hmm.
Is that that's really what the play is about? It's Admetus's Xenia problem, and not so much Alcestis. But we can come back around to that.
Of course. So then the prologue opens with Apollo. Death shows up. Thanatos, the personification of death. He's a god in his own right. He sees Apollo. He's a little perturbed. He says, "What are you doing here, Apollo? This is my jurisdiction. I'm going to take someone from this house, just like I was promised." And Apollo, you know, they have a little back and forth, a little stichomathia, right? Exchange of lines. And Apollo says, "Don't worry. I realize that you're going to get your victim, but here's the catch."
Right. So as it turns out, you know, Admetus's death day is coming up. Apollo, being Apollo, knows this. So Apollo, in his own words, says he's tricked the fates and he's allowed Admetus to skip out on his death day, but only if he finds somebody else to die in his place.
A substitute.
And so apparently Admetus has found one in his wife, and Alcestis has agreed to die. And so Apollo says to death, don't worry. You're not going to get Admetus, but you're still going to get your body.
But he also says, even she will be taken away from you.
Right.
And here comes the deus ex machina, this big, burly, brawny character.
Heracles.
Yeah.
So Heracles, there's really no suspense in some ways in the play. I mean, the Greeks weren't about suspense.
No. For the most part, the audience knows.
They know
the
these
basic
stories.
Lineaments of the story.
Right. And so, you know, Euripides didn't come up with this tale himself.
No.
Right. So, but Apollo says that, death, you're going to get Alcestis, but hold on a minute, buddy. Heracles is going to be coming along, and he's going to actually take this woman away from you.
Yeah, I have the sense that the Athenian audience would really love a good remake.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
When Karate Kid was redone recently, I hear that was a total dud.
I watched it with my boys. It was a dud. It was, right. As someone who fell in love with the 1984 Ralph Macchio.
Did he sweep the leg?
There was something else. I think I nodded off by that point, but they had some other kind of move.
Was it Will Smith's son who played the lead?
Yeah, he was fine, but I've been impressed with him as an actor. There's no need to remake that film.
No, but the Athenians would love a good remake.
Yes.
As a remake. Because they love the original story and they would want to see what can the poet do to bring this story to life again.
That's where the suspense is.
Right.
Right. So yeah, it's that whole, we've talked about this in earlier episodes, you know, if one story, one version of a story is good, four is better.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's very different than contemporary audiences. I mean, contemporary to you and me, I think, because what we crave is originality.
Yes. Right.
And do you think I'm right?
I think you're absolutely right.
About this or about everything?
I think, well, just about this, yeah. About little else, actually.
Okay.
But I think, as you and I, students of myth, and I think other students of myth would agree, there's very little originality out there. It's the originality is where your ability to take something that's known and do something new with it.
Master the conventions of the genre, but then innovate on them in minor, but surprising ways.
Yes, I think I heard somebody else say
that.
Yeah,
you may have heard that before. All right, so then we have the exchange between the chorus, the nice choral ode that was read in the last episode, and the servant. And we talked about how Euripides inverts the traditional order. Instead of having a messenger report on the death that happens off stage, the messenger reports that someone is dying off stage, and then Alcestis herself is wheeled out for the actual death.
Right, so it's a almost death scene. Yeah, I wonder if the audience kind of heard this servant speech and kind of says, "Oh, I know where this is going," and then Euripides, in his typical fashion, he pulls out the rug and gives us something else.
Yeah, so this is one of the places where the Athenian audience might laugh.
Yeah, they might laugh, or they might be turned off by it. It does seem that there's that tradition about Athenian audiences being rather conservative in their tastes, and Euripides liking to play with that. So either they saw it as comic or
poke them in the ear a little bit.
Exactly, right.
Okay, so here around line 250, we have the first appearance of Admetus the king and Alcestis on the stage. Jeff, read some of that for us, will you please?
Right, so Alcestis speaks first. She says, "Sweet sunlight streaming through whirling clouds." Admetus, "The god of that sunlight looks down upon us both, my darling. Two innocent people who don't deserve this." Alcestis, "Ah, my bed, my house, my home." Admetus, "Get up, my love. Don't leave me. Please. If some god has his hands on you, beg for mercy." Alcestis, "I can see Charon, the ferryman, in his little boat. He's steering my way and calling. What's keeping you? I have a job to do. He compels me. Impatient. Cruel." Admetus, "No, don't say it. Oh, the things we are suffering, dear wife."
I really like that translation, and read with so much sincere emotion. I felt like I too was looking at the boat of Charon in the distance.
Thank you. I put you right there.
Do you think there's melodrama in this?
Oh, it's soaked in melodrama. You know, it's. I mean, we were talking earlier about how, you know, one of the things that is so interesting about this play is that it pulls you between the tragedy and the comedy. And just as I'm reading my own translation here, this strikes me as almost ridiculously comic.
Yeah, it reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from The Simpsons, where Lisa and Bart are competing in the kids' news. You might remember that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Lisa says, "Well, if it's melodrama they want, I'll fill them so full of sap they'll be blowing their nose with a pancake."
That's perfect. That's a perfect description of the scene here. I mean, I see, you know, Alcestis, you know, swooning back with her hand on her forehead, right? You know, sweet sunlight. I can see Charon. It's like, you know, it's getting dark. It's getting darker.
She does take a long time to die.
Oh, a long time. And she's not even close to being done here.
Right? How many lines would you say?
I don't even know, but it's a long scene. And she kind of comes back, and then she swoons, and she comes back. So, I mean, it strikes me as just kind of almost ridiculously comic.
But if it's played for laughs, wherein lies the tragedy?
Well, I don't know. Euripides is dealing in some kind of comedy of discomfort.
Mm.
You know, the audience thinking that, I mean, this is a serious scene. This wife has chosen to die for her husband.
Comedy of the awkward.
Comedy of the awkward, like the Office or something like that. So, Euripides, you know, reveling in making his audience uncomfortable. Mm.
You want to laugh because it's so ridiculous, but you feel a little bit ashamed or embarrassed.
Right.
If you have adequate character, I guess.
Right. Does it strike you as comic?
Well, I would say it strikes me as tragicomic, melodramatico tragicomic, perhaps.
Ooh, I like that term.
Thank you. It's like one of those mouth-busting Aeschylean words that we talked about last time.
Right.
So every time that Alcestis talks about her death, Admetus tends to glom on and try to squeeze some pity for himself out of the exchange.
And it's really cringy when he says, you know, don't leave me. This was his idea, right? He asked her to die in
his
place.
She's leaving so that he doesn't have to.
Right. And I suppose you could read this as, you know, now he's confronted with the reality of things, that he's so thunderstruck with grief that he's saying these ridiculous things. But again, it strikes me as, what's wrong with this guy?
Yes, exactly. Well, this introduces into my mind a certain theological note that I'd like to make at the end.
Okay.
So if you can remind me.
I'll try to remember.
When we get to the end.
Yeah.
It's going to be a little theological. I have to forewarn everyone.
Okay. All right. Yes. Well, I look forward to that.
Okay. So then long about line 305, Alcestis has a really long and interesting speech where she begins to criticize her in-laws.
Exactly. You want to read a little bit of that for us?
I do.
Yeah,
yes.
Do it.
This is from Dr. Arntzen Svarlian's translation, the Hackett edition. And yet your parents, Alcestis says to her husband Admetus, and yet your parents both betrayed you. They had reached the point where death was best for them. To save their child and their reputation would have been best. You were their only one, that is, their only child. They had no hope, if you died, of more children. We could have lived our days out, you and I, and you would not be moaning now, bereaved, caring for motherless children. As it is, some god arranged that things should be this way. Ah, well.
Ah, well. And this is the Admetus revisits the same charge. He throws this back at his dad later on in the play.
But kind of half-hearted, isn't it?
Well, I mean, he's flailing at that point.
Okay.
Right. But this is really interesting that Alcestis is saying, you know, your parents were almost dead anyway.
Right.
What was ahead for them?
They should have taken one for the team.
Right.
Why am I forced to do it at the expense of our children?
So Admetus, later on, trying to salvage some, you know, threat of his reputation, takes the same charge and throws it back to his father.
Yes. So as we see Euripides continue to develop the character of Admetus, how does he respond to the death, both before and after?
And once again, Admetus just goes too far. He's making all kinds of promises that will ultimately destroy him. Alcestis gets him to promise in her death throes to never marry someone again. The reasoning that she gives is that she doesn't want a wicked stepmother,
right,
for her children.
A common theme in ancient literature.
Yeah, and fairy tales.
Yeah, the noverca in Latin, the wicked stepmother who's prone to poison, as Ovid says.
Right, so Alcestis knows her stories and doesn't want this for her children. And so Admetus, in his typical fashion, he agrees and amplifies. He says, not only that, but I'll do this. And so he says, all the music, all the parties, all the revelry for which our house was so famous, all of it is done. No more. I'm done playing and singing my music. Your death puts an end to all that. What's left to celebrate? And what's more, I will hire the best craftsman I can track down and have him carve a splendid image of you. And then I will place it in my bed and I will hold, kiss, and caress it as if it were you yourself. And I will pretend that I hold my dear wife in my arms, a cold delight, yes, but maybe it will lighten the weight on my heart at least a little bit. Maybe then I'll see you in my dreams. That's something, isn't it?
That's your translation, right?
It is.
Very nicely done, but also so creepy.
Oh, it's so weird.
He's going to make a mannequin of sorts and sleep with it.
Is he just freestyling here? There seems to be no real...
What do you mean by freestyling?
Like
Isn't it like a soda machine or something?
Not like a soda machine. Like he's not thinking about what he's saying at all.
No. I think that part of what Euripides is showing us is a man who is good at everything except the one thing he ought to do, which is die himself instead of having his wife do it. So he is great at making extravagant promises. He's great at expressing sincere emotion and affection for his wife when she's there, and he promises he'll do it when she's gone. He's also great at providing hospitality to Hercules. But the one thing he ought to be doing, he has no interest in whatsoever.
Right.
Which is dying himself instead of letting her do it.
If he had done that, none of this would happen.
No. So there's one last little element in the characterization of Admetus by Euripides that I would like to mention before we get the entrance of Hercules.
Great. You have something from Diane's translation.
Yes, I do. So this is line 380 or so. Alcestis says, "Time will soften your grief," speaking to her husband. "The dead are nothing. Admetus, please, by the gods, take me with you down below." Alcestis, "I'm dying for you. My death is sufficient." Admetus, "Gods, what a wife you steal away from me."
Now, it may just be the kind of the mood that we're in, but it's so hard not to read that as not being ridiculous.
Right, as comedy.
Yes.
Right? This total coward of a man loves his wife so much that he says, "As you die in my place, take me with you." And she says, "I'm dying for you. My death is..." Isn't that enough? It strikes me as just ridiculous.
It is. If that's not signal for comedy enough, here comes Heracles, right? And so Heracles, famous for so many things in Greek mythology, he's a kind of a hero of brute force. He's a suffering hero, but he also shows up as a comic character in many regards. He's got these unending appetites for booze and for food,
right? He's and often, women.
He's drunk. So I think to an audience, the arrival of Heracles, it could signal tragedy or comedy.
Right. I kind of think of him as the Incredible Hulk with a six-pack.
That's good. That's good. Exactly right.
So the listener will remember that Heracles is here at the court of Admetus because he's on his way to Thrace to capture the wild mares of Diomedes. And he's just stopping off for the night.
That's right. So let me read here a bit from my own translation here where Heracles comes in. He says, "Hey there, strangers. You don't happen to know if Admetus is home, do you?" And the chorus leader says, "Why, hello, Heracles. Yes, he's at home. What brings you to this neck of the woods?" Heracles, "Oh, I'm up north performing another one of my labors for King Eurystheus of Tiryns. Heard of him?" Chorus leader, "Oh, do tell. What exactly do you have to do this time?" Heracles, "Well, I'm going all the way up to Thrace. I'm going to nab the four-horse chariot out from under old King, Diomedes. Yeah, him." Chorus leader, "You can't be serious. Surely you've heard about what kind of a host that man is." "Nope, not a thing. He lives, here it is, Bistonia. Never been there."
So Heracles has a standard comic entrance. There's confusion. There's mistaken identity. Who is this? What's he doing here? I don't know really where I'm going. There's the reference or the allusion. Eurystheus has got you off on another one of your labors. And Hercules kind of plays dumb or really is dumb. But he's going to turn out to be the savior of the entire episode, of the entire tragedy itself.
Right. Yeah. So in my own translation, I mean, I'm massaging the language to make Heracles sound a little bit like a dumb jock, right? But he's come to Admetus for a party, right?
Is this like a true confessional of high school Winkle or something?
There might be something buried in there.
All right.
We don't have time for that. But the heroism is later. Now is the time to kind of relax. And so I think that, I imagine Heracles showing up in stage dress with the garlands already in his hair, right? So I think
the garlands prepared for the drinking.
The drinking and the partying.
Yep.
So
Admetus is supposed to give him a welcome reception because he's a famous host.
We just saw earlier that he says the hospitality that our house was famous for, all of that's done. Now we'll see if Admetus can actually keep that promise.
So in these last two episodes, we've been featuring not only your original translation, Jeff, which I think is quite nice, but the one by Diane Arntzen's Farlian. And like last time, we're going to have a little bit of the reading from the author herself,
Great.
The translator herself.
Great.
But that's coming up after a word from our sponsors.
This episode of Ad Nauseam brought to you by Hackett Publishing. Hackett Publishing, since 1972, has been an independent publisher of high-quality translations in the field of classics, as well as many other corners of the humanities. Dave, can you tell us about some of the work that Hackett has to offer?
Well, sure, Jeff. They have a broad catalog of classics of all kinds, from Greek and Roman classics. They have a new verse translation of the Epic of Gilgamesh. I've used their philosophy texts, like their translations of the Republic and also Descartes in some of my courses, and they have a lot of great stuff. So, Jeff, can you share with our Ad Nauseam listeners what Hackett has for them?
From now until December 31st, Ad Nauseam listeners can save 20% on any order and receive free shipping from Hackett Publishing. All you have to do is go to hackettpublishing.com, that's two T's in Hackett, find the text that you want, enter AN2020 in the box, which asks for the coupon code.
That's a great deal. Don't hesitate. Go to hackettpublishing.com today.
Are you a coffee drinker, Dave?
Oh, I love a good cup of coffee.
Well, how do you get your daily cup of delight, the sort of brew that sustains you while you wade through exams and quizzes, preparing intricate and soul-breaking assignments for your poor students?
Well, I don't like to break their souls too much, you see. But I get a good cup of coffee from my Ratio 8 machine. This is an automatic pour-over coffee maker.
I've seen that machine. You really love it, don't you?
Yes, I do. It sits right on my countertop. It's a thing of beauty. It's perfectly designed and engineered. It's got no junk in it. It's all high-grade materials, aluminum and real wood, walnut accents, and this sort of thing. It's very beautiful.
And I understand it actually brews some good coffee, too?
It's fantastic. Unlike the pour-over method where you have to stand there and actually pour over into a cone and funnel, the Ratio 8 and its little brother, the 6, it does all of this for you. It's automated. What kind of coffee maker gives you that? So, Jeff, what can our listeners get from Ratio Coffee?
Ratio now is offering 15% off their Ratio 6. It's featured at places like Crate and Barrel and Williams-Sonoma. But Ad Nauseam listeners can get a direct-to-consumer discount by going to ratiocoffee.com and entering our special code ANCO. And they will get 15% off the Ratio 6 between now and March 20, 2021. Go to ratiocoffee.com and enter special code ANCO for 15% off the Ratio 6.
Check it out.
Child, who do you think I am? Some Lydian or Phrygian slave you bought and paid for? Listen, don't speak to me that way. I'm a Thessalian, freeborn, legitimate. So was my father. This is an outrage. Where do you get off flinging these childish accusations at me? I gave you life and raised you to be a master of this estate. I'm not obliged to die to suit your whims. There's no ancestral custom that fathers give their lives to save their children. No Greek law either. Your fortune, good or bad, is yours and no one else's. What I owe you, you have already. You rule a wide domain, and I will leave you many acres more as my father did for me. So tell me this. How have I wronged you? How have you been deprived? Don't die for me, and I won't die for you. You love to be alive, to see the daylight. What makes you think your father doesn't? Really, the way I see it, we'll have lots of time once we go down below. Our lives are short. Still, they're sweet. So, you put up a fight, got out of dying, shamelessly stayed alive, avoided your due fate by killing her. You're calling me a coward? You're the worst! You've been outdone by your wife, who had the courage to give her own life for her fine young man. You've found a smart alternative to death. Just persuade your current wife to die on your behalf. And then you blame your loved ones if they won't do it. Coward that you are. Give me a break. You love your life, of course, but so does everyone. If you go on insulting me, then be prepared to hear some really ugly truths about yourself.
This is a powerful, unsettling scene. Once Admetus lashes out at his father drops any pretense of politeness or condolence and just lets Admetus have it.
No respect for him.
No respect at all. You know, how could you, what kind of man are you letting your wife die for you? I love these lines where he says, Admetus also says, like his wife did, why didn't you die for me? You had a chance and mom had a chance to die for me, but look at you, you go on living. And Pheres says, listen, just because I'm old, it doesn't mean I don't like living. I like look like the sun on my face like anybody else.
Right.
And he says, I have no obligation to die for you. And he even says something very literally like, that's not Greek. Hmm. We Greeks don't do that. And so I find those really striking lines. And if you look at Greek legends, there's not a tradition of sacrificial death along these lines. I mean, Pheres is right to some degree.
Definitely. I like this line here in the translation. There's no ancestral custom. I think this is what you're referring to.
Yes, exactly.
There's no ancestral custom that fathers give their lives to save their children. No Greek law either.
Yeah.
So it's not a part of custom. It's not a part of law that I, Pheres, should have to die for my son, Admetus. So where does Admetus get off, so to speak, insisting that his father die in his place?
Yeah, again, he's flailing about. In some ways, the argument isn't even his own, right?
No.
He stole it from his dead wife.
So the next part that comes up, this is around line 750 or so, is this really interesting exchange between Pheres and Admetus, a continuation, but they go back and forth line for line, and it's really a duel of cowards, I would say.
Yeah.
Is that how you see it, Jeff?
I think that's right on. I mean, I certainly kind of, Admetus' cowardice jumps out more for me. In some ways, Pheres is he's blunt and he's unsympathetic in his own right, but it's really Admetus whose cowardice and ridiculousness is on display here.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're going to read a few lines of that exchange?
Sure. So, you know, Admetus is he's lashed out at his father and for not dying for him. And I'll pick it up in kind of midstream. So Pheres says, "Son, what is your problem? How exactly have I done you any wrong?" Admetus says, "It's your unseemly lust for a long life. It's sickening." Pheres, "You're the one buying himself a longer life with someone else's corpse." Admetus, "Yes, an embarrassing reminder of your selfishness, you coward." Pheres, "That word again. I had nothing to do with her death, nothing." Admetus, "Oh, I can't wait for the day when you might need my help." Pheres, "Just keep on living, my son. Woo 100 women and kill them off one by one." Admetus, "Even if I did that, each one would be an insult to you. You refused when you should have died." Pheres, "Of course I refused. Sunlight is sweet."
So no love lost between these two characters.
None.
Yeah, Admetus is a coward. Pheres, to your mind, not quite so bad, but they're both behaving in a pretty craven fashion.
Very craven. You can see the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree here.
Yes, right? Definitely.
And so Admetus, cuts his father and also his mother, who doesn't appear on stage, out of his life. And so Admetus keeps isolating himself more and more and more.
Yeah, don't forget he has that statue to cling to, though, to cry himself to sleep.
Well,
at
he
night.
Always has that statue.
Right.
Right.
And Heracles, now he's going to enter the scene. We
right.
need to get on to Heracles, who's going to save the day, as I mentioned before.
Right. So Heracles, the servant, finally calls him out. He's been carrying on. Kind of, he's been drunk. He's been loud. He's irritating everybody else in the house. Who's said this? There's a funeral going on. Who is this guy? How dare he do this? And that's where Heracles finally realizes that Alcestis is dead, and he feels horrible about this
because he's been boozing it up in the servants' hall.
Right. And if you think about kind of how a tragic stage was arranged, they had you had the kind of the circular orchestra and the three doors in the back. It's kind of a classic, like you were saying, kind of comedy of error setup. You could say the door on the left, that's the house in mourning. The door on the right is the house of revel. And Admetus is kind of torn between them,
going back and forth
between them,
trying to attend to the funeral, but also trying to be a good host, show his hyperphilozenia to Heracles.
Exactly. And then it all explodes here when Heracles realizes what exactly has been going on.
So there's quite an exchange here between the servant and Heracles. The servants and the anonymous characters generally, like the shepherd in Oedipus Rex, they tend to drive the action, whereas the main characters react to it for the most part.
Yeah, indeed.
The servants give the speeches. So here the servant lets it slip to Heracles, that it is the woman of the house, Alcestis, who has died. And then in response to the servant, Heracles says, this is around line 875 from Diane's translation, "I did notice, I saw, his eyes were wet," meaning Admetus, "his shorn hair, his expression, but he insisted that it was an outsider's funeral. I knew I shouldn't fling the doors open wide, shouldn't drink in the home of a generous host when that was happening, yet here I am with garlands on my head. And you didn't tell me just how much this household suffered. Where is he burying her? Where can I find her?"
So from there, Heracles, feeling terrible, decides that he's going to do something about it. And so he goes and he wrestles death and brings Alcestis back. But it's not just, hey, here, Admetus, here's your wife back. He's going to use this opportunity to teach Admetus a lesson at the same time.
Is Admetus susceptible to instruction?
Well, no. All he knows is how to throw a party. All he knows is how to be a host. And so Heracles coming by again, Admetus, I think, is thinking of, how am I going to make this guy happy?
Hmm.
How am I going to please this demigod?
Yeah, this famous hero.
Right.
This very popular character. So is another of Admetus's flaws is just that he's shallow?
That might be his principal flaw.
Okay.
To some degree, that he's so one-dimensional.
He doesn't know how to behave in different circumstances?
No, he morphs kind of based on the situation that he's in. And so, you know, when he's with Apollo and he's with Heracles, he defers to these greater men. And he will lie or stretch the truth just in the hopes of kind of keeping them happy.
But Heracles is not happy because it turns out he's a bad host. He's boozing and carousing while the woman of the house is dead.
He's made Heracles look really bad.
That's right. So he decides to do something about it.
That's right. So he's going to go down to Hades and bring his wife back. Let me read a little bit from my translation. And this is Heracles more or less kind of pumping himself up, giving himself a pep talk. He says, "Okay, Heracles, time to show what the son of Tirinthian Alcmene and Olympian Zeus is made of. It's up to me to fix this and bring this woman back. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to track down that black-robed bugger, Death himself. I'll sneak up on him, put him in a headlock, and squeeze his puny neck until he gives me what I want. And I know just where to find him, lurking around the tomb, slurping up libation after libation. But if he's already moved on, then I'll go down into hell itself and request that Persephone and Lord Hades give Alcestis over to me. And from there, I shall place her back into the arms of my dear friend Admetus. I mean, now that I think about it, what a guy. Absolutely crushed with grief, and he still takes me in? Is there anyone in all of Thessaly or even Greece even more hospitable than this man? Well, his nobility and respect demand a noble gesture in return. Let no one ever say that Heracles was an ungrateful guest."
Well, that lays it out pretty plainly. Jeff, what do you think about what's driving Heracles here? Is it his own love for Admetus? Is it a sense of pride?
I think it's definitely both of those things. I think there's, the play doesn't give us any reason to suggest that there's not real affection between these two guys. I mean, they're like drinking buddies. You know, they're not soulmates. I see in his words here that he's trying to salvage his own reputation.
Hercules is trying to salvage his reputation.
Right, and so by justifying what Admetus did, you know, he says, you know, now that I think about it, what a great host.
Right,
and so if he can justify what Admetus does, it makes his carousing acceptable or more acceptable.
So he goes down in the underworld to the underworld. He does in fact succeed in bringing back Alcestis, but there's a kind of a caveat or qualification. She's not supposed to speak for 3 days. Am I remembering correctly?
That's true. That comes out at the end. But he sends it. It's also clear that Heracles wants to teach Admetus a little bit of a lesson here, right? So he doesn't come back and say, "This woman, that's your wife." It's back. He tells a lie. He says, "Listen, I won this woman in some games that I competed in. There were horses, there were other trophies, and I won this woman. And because you were such a good host, I want to give her to you."
This seems like Heracles giving Admetus a little bit of his own medicine, because very early on in the play, when the two were having the exchange about who in the home had died, Admetus worked overtime to conceal from Heracles the identity of the deceased, that it wasn't really his wife. There was a lot of double talk. And that doesn't seem like good friendship at all.
It zeroes in on Admetus's flaws once again. Right. So, I mean, I think Heracles is willing to forgive, but he's going to make his friend squirm a little bit. Right. So he comes out. He's fairly blunt to Admetus. He says, "You lied to me and I'm not happy about it. But to kind of show you that there's no hard feelings and I still love you, here's this woman prize that I'm going to give to you."
But she's veiled.
She's veiled.
We can't see her identity.
Right.
She's quiet. Admetus has to wait some time before she is revealed. It seems like it slowly begins to dawn on Admetus, the identity of this veiled figure. And so he says, this is Diane's translation, about line 1120, "Whoever you are, woman, you resemble my Alcestis in shape. Your body is like hers. Oh God, please take this woman away where I can't see her. By all the gods, stop tightening the grip that holds me fast already. When I look at her, I think I see my wife. My heart is pounding. Tears are bursting from my eyes. I'm suffering. Oh, I have just now tasted the real bitterness of all my pain."
Yeah, so I have to think Heracles is enjoying this a little bit. Right?
Oh, definitely, because his next comment suggests that.
Do you have the translation right there? What does he say next?
The chorus has a little interlude, and then Heracles says, "If only I had strength enough to bring your wife back from the halls below to daylight." So this is irony, right? Deep irony. If only I could do that favor for you.
Right, so he's both punishing Admetus, but he's also enjoying kind of this surprise gift, right?
Right.
He's also waiting for the time where he sees his friend rejoicing with this very unlikely reversal of fortune, right?
But all Admetus can do, yes, that's right, is continue on with his own self-centeredness. I know that you would like to, he says to Heracles, but what's the point? The dead cannot be brought back to the light. Don't overdo your grief, Heracles says. Be moderate. This is odd advice coming from Heracles, who is moderate in nothing.
Right,
right. But here, not only is he the hero of the poem, but of the tragedy, but he also seems to be dispensing moral advice.
Yeah, and this is a good moment also to remind ourselves of, remember that Alcestis drew a deathbed promise for Admetus to never take another woman into the house.
Right.
So Admetus is in this vice now where he has either got to listen to or remember the promise he made to his dying wife, or he's going to be the people-pleasing superhost once again, his obligation, at least he feels he has to Heracles.
So he's stuck between the two. Heracles wants to give him this woman who is actually Alcestis.
Right. Again,
Admetus doesn't know it.
Yeah.
But he's made this promise to his dead wife. Is he just going to fall back on the statue?
That's that statue again. Well, I think the statue comes into play here in terms of kind of the imagery that the text suggests. So, who does he choose to listen to? He chooses to listen to Heracles. And he doesn't want to offend his host once again, and he reluctantly takes this woman. I think the language that he uses, that it says it's like Perseus dealing with the Gorgon. Like he reaches out and he can't even bear to even look at the woman as he takes her. And then that deep irony, of course, by taking his wife's hand, he breaks that solemn promise that he made to his wife. It's really kind of, I mean, that's one of the things I love about this play, how those things kind of, they come together and just explode in that moment.
So now we're finally up to the recognition scene, the discovery. Admetus realizes that this woman, this gift of Heracles, is actually his wife Alcestis.
Right.
And can you read a portion of that for us, Jeff, from your own translation?
I will. So Admetus finally succumbs to Heracles and takes the woman. Admetus says, fine, I'll take her. It's like I'm cutting the head off a Gorgon. Heracles, good. You got her? Admetus, yes, Heracles, I have her. Heracles, now take care of her. One day, I promise you, you'll say that this son of Zeus is the best guest you've ever had. And at that point, it's Alcestis's veil is removed. Ta-da! Now look at her. Does she look like anybody you might know? Admetus, my friend put an end to your mourning. Admetus, by Zeus, how can this be? Is this really my wife, is it? Or are the gods just playing some horrible trick on me? Heracles, it's her and no one else. Your Alcestis is back.
But of course, Admetus' suffering is not completely over.
It's not.
Because Alcestis is going to remain silent for 3 days. As Diane says in her translation, Admetus, and why is she just standing there in silence, Heracles? It's not yet right for you to hear her voice. She's consecrated to the gods below and will not be released until the third day's light has come. Go on, take her inside. Admetus, please continue ever after to be a just man, pious toward your guests. And now for farewell, I must complete the labor laid out for me by Sthenelus's tyrant son. So it's interesting to me that Heracles tells him specifically, continue to be a just man, pious toward your guests. Are we to take this as facetious?
Well, it's a really weird little speech there. I mean, also call attention to Heracles seems to know a lot about the rules of resurrection, right?
Well, he has had a catabasis. He's been to the underworld before.
That's true. Good point. And I suppose we could take him at his word and say, oh, that's why she's not speaking. Though I find it still really unsettling. So, I mean, this brings us back to the statue. So, you know, Admetus has promised to make this statue, and then when his wife returns, she's basically a statue.
Right.
She doesn't speak. The fact
she's quiet, she's inanimate, she has no particular point to make in the story.
Yeah. And so we don't get her reaction to this at all, and I think that's really creepy.
Well, we could speculate a little bit, psychologize Admetus. He doesn't really love his wife. He just loves what she represents.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of it that way. Yeah.
So, Jeff, before we talk a little bit more about some interpretive elements and we wind up this episode, can you read us the last little choral tag from your translation? Yeah. Often these choral tags, they're the takeaway for the audience, kind of the last thing that the poet wants us to remember.
Yes. And so the chorus sage is this very brief little song. The gods can seem so disconnected. They bring about the unexpected. When men seem weak, the gods prevail. Such describes and ends this tale.
So how do you see the conclusion of this play, Jeff? Are the gods just? Does Admetus get treated well? These are some of the questions I think we should look at briefly as we conclude.
Yeah, and despite, you know, this choral tag at the end, which would seem to steer, I guess, the interpretation of the play more towards comedy, you know, or a happy ending, the ending has always struck me as tragic, and for a couple of reasons. I find the silence of Alcestis so telling and so unsettling. And then two, it always takes me back to the backstory. So if there's, you know, this ledger of fate, so if Alcestis is back, shouldn't that mean in the calculus of things that Admetus's death is still on the table? So as I understand it, there are two kind of main avenues of interpretation out there for this play. One is along the lines that I just said, that at Alcestis returns, that means Admetus is either going to die or he's going to have to find somebody else to die for him. Or is the more kind of positive, optimistic view is that Heracles, whatever he did with death, he didn't end run around this. He found a loophole. And he found a way for Alcestis to come back and for Admetus to stay alive. And I'm somewhat torn between those two, but I tend more towards kind of the tragic. I find the more interesting ending, I should say, is that Admetus's death is still on the table. So what's your take on this?
Well, I really like Euripides because he is at a moment of transition from the old world of Homer and Aeschylean and Sophoclean kind of morality to the new world represented by the Peloponnesian War. So I like this quote from the scholar E.R. Dodds. This is from his work, The Ancient Concept of Progress, Oxford, 1971. Dodds says, "To the Christian, it is a necessary part of piety to believe that God is just." So I think that's pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. Christians believe that God is just. There's a just God supervising, overseeing the affairs of humanity. Dodds continues, "And so it was to Plato and to the Stoics. But the older world saw no such necessity." So Plato, living just after the time of Euripides, very near contemporaries, Plato and the Stoics, they share with Christianity this concept of the justness of the gods. Hmm. So they wouldn't have expressed it primarily in monotheistic terms, but in polytheistic terms. Nevertheless, the gods were just. They had to do what was right. Euripides is right at that moment where these two worlds are in transition. The world of Homer and Aeschylus and Sophocles, the gods are defined by power more than anything else, not by justice. And so in Euripides, we get to see these two ideas really competing. And it doesn't seem to me Euripides has worked out all his ideas completely.
Right. Sometimes he's even referred to, of the big three, he's the atheist.
Or yes. I don't think that's fair.
No, it goes way too far. But, I mean, deeply troubled,
right.
Skeptical. You know, are the gods knowable? Mm-hmm. Can we trust them?
Well, so in the Hippolytus, for example, we have famously, by way of comparison, the two characters of Aphrodite and Artemis, and they come to be almost representations of psychological forces. Mm-hmm. As Rose says, Artemis is chastity, Aphrodite is the force of passion. And why is Hippolytus ruined? Because he has an inhuman devotion to one aspect of human character, namely self-control.
Yeah.
So self-control is going to ruin you in the end if that's your only quality.
Right. That seems to be kind of a Euripidean theme.
Definitely.
That a character who represents the extreme of, you know, fill in the blank.
Well, Medea, right? It's her honor more than anything else. So should a character have high honor? Yes. But what if Achilles were a woman? What if this kind of Homeric notion of defend your honor at all cost, what if that's within the context of a family, a domestic life? And so Medea is monstrous because she acts like a Homeric hero.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Or think of the Bacchae too, where you mm-hmm. have, you know, Pentheus and Dionysus representing kind of these extreme poles of rationality and irrationality.
Right.
And something has to give.
So for Alcestis, this play, the character of Admetus is the good quality, the very highly celebrated Greek quality of Xenia, the Eumaeus from the Odyssey, right? Odyssey book 14, Eumaeus, the loyal swineherd, he shows Xenia, and it's all throughout the Homeric corpus and elsewhere. Now let's put this in the context of a family and add in the element of death. What kind of a person does Admetus end up being?
Yeah.
You can be so committed to hospitality that it takes you to other absurd extremes.
Yeah, it's as if everybody says X is good, but what happens if we turn that amp up to 11
mm-hmm.
on this and watch things fall apart?
Right. And so that was most of the theological note that I wanted to make that I promised earlier.
Right.
But the other part of it is the question of who's worth dying for. The concept of self-sacrifice. Alcestis is a noble, self-sacrificing character, but is it noble to die for someone who is wretched? Someone like Admetus. So that's a question I would like to leave the listener with. Is it noble to die for someone wretched?
All right, let's wrap it up here. So listeners, a great way that you can help us out is to leave us a nice review, a nice note on whatever platform you're using to listen to this podcast. We love hearing from you. We're really thankful for some of the really nice notes that you've passed along. You can send your questions, your comments to dave@adnauseum.com or to me at jeff@adnauseum.com. As always, we invite you to check out the website. We've got some wonderful, attractive t-shirts for you to look at and for you to buy. Don't hesitate to let us know what you're thinking. Now, Dave, tell us what's going on for next week.
Well, next week we're going to accelerate from 5th century BC all the way to 16th century AD, and we're going to look at a Puritan author, a man named William Perkins, and his take on the classics. So it's William Perkins, Aristotle, and what's called the Ars Memoriae, that is the art of memory. How do we remember things? What's the best way? What's the worst way? We're going to look at some interesting Latin and some controversy in the late 16th century.
Can't wait.
And Jeff, you get our gustatory parting shot this week.
I do. This is from Calvin Trillin, who writes, "The most remarkable thing about my mother is that for 30 years, she served the family nothing but leftovers. The original meal has never been found."
That's great. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.